So here is the genera strategy. It's sort of two genera, so I will make it more precise. But first, let me just outline the strategy. So let F be a family of discrete objects, and somehow define a convergence notion on F. So introduce the notion of convergence on these discrete structures. And then, once you have a convergence notion, you can take the closure of this family of discrete structure, and then you can apply analytic methods on this closure. So the most classical example is, of course, the set of rational numbers. This is a discrete family of discrete objects, and there is a very natural topological closure, namely the real numbers, and once you have this topological closure, you can do variational methods and you can do analysis on it. So it's useful. But somehow our further examples will be totally different from this first example. You will see why. So the second example will be more typical. So this is our basic example, actually. And this is classical ergodic theory by Fürstenberg. So what is the collection of discrete objects here? This is the subset of finite cyclic groups. So let's take a natural number n and the subset S of the cyclic group of order n. Okay? So the collection of all these structures is called F. And how do we introduce the convergence notion? So we have to introduce sampling from these structures. So sampling will be crucial in this talk. So a random K sample from such a structure is the following. You take K consecutive elements from the cyclic group, a plus 1, and so on, a plus k minus 1, uniformly at random. So you pick a uniformly at random, and then you take the intersection of a with your subset f. So there are 2 to the k possible patterns that you can get this way, right, inside this interval. So this is a k sample, and you have just a bounded number of possibilities. So what you have is a random K by sampling such a random K sample, you get a probability distribution on these 2 to the K possibilities, right? So you associate a probability distribution with every such structure S if you fix a K. Okay? Now, a sequence S1, S2, and so on from this big F is called convergent if for every fixed K, the distribution of K samples converge as distributions. So you know what it means. So what you can do here is the following. I call it gluing. Probably it's not the best word for it, but let me call it gluing. So if you have a convergent sequence, S1, S2, and so on, then there is a limiting sample distribution for every K. That's clear, because we assume that they converge. But then we can glue these limiting distributions together in some way. I will tell you how. And what you get is a probability Borel measure mu on this topological, compact topological space. This is just the two-element set raised to the zth power. This is the set of integers. So what is this? This is the space of infinite 0-1 sequences. So since this is a product of compact topological spaces, right, the two elements that is a compact topological space, this is a compact topological space. And you can define a probability measure mu, which is coming from this compact convergence sequence, and this probability measure will be invariant under the natural action of the infinite cyclic group, which is just the shift on the infinite zero-band sequences, right? There is a natural action on this topological space, and this probability measure that you obtain will be invariant under this Bernoulli shift. So how do you get this measure mu? Somehow you glue together this limiting distribution. So if you want to define a measure, a Borel measure on this space, you have to determine it on a basis for the open sets. So what is a nice basis? You take cylinder sets. But actually it's enough to take those cylinder sets where you fix a finite number of consecutive digits, right? That's an open subset of this space. But that will be exactly the, you have to determine the measure on this open set. But this will be exactly the probability if you fix k consecutive digits here and you fix a pattern, that will be exactly the corresponding probability of the, that will be the probability of the corresponding k sample, right? So that's straightforward. So, and you somehow can glue together this limiting distribution to form one nice infinite object, which you can regard the limit object of this discrete structure. So that's a topological closure. Now, this example helps us to define a more specific strategy. So here is the more specific strategy. So start with a family of discrete objects, okay? And let S be a family of sampling procedures. So you have more than one sampling procedure. Remember that in the ergodic theory case, for every k, you had a sampling procedure. You fix k consecutive digits. So you have a family of sampling procedures on the elements of S. And now a sequence from this big S is called convergent if every fixed sampling procedure converges in distribution. That's what people usually call a weak limit. And then you can take the topological closure of the family of discrete structure with respect to this convergence notion. And if you are lucky, in all of the cases I'm going to show, you are lucky, you can do gluing. You somehow, okay, so if you have a convergent sequence, then there are limiting sample distributions, right? For every sampling procedure, you have a limiting sample distribution. And somehow, in many cases, you can glue them together to one single object, to one single probability distribution. How? Okay, I can't explain it precisely because this is not precise, but what you have is that usually these sampling procedures are forming a partial ordered set somehow. And you can take a certain inverse limit with respect to the sampling, with respect to this partial ordered set. The thing is that if there is one sampling procedure which is bigger than another sampling procedure, then you can get a sample from the smaller for the smaller sampling procedure by first sampling according to the bigger one, and then you restrict, you do another sampling. So there is some natural partial ordering. And this way you get a partial order set, and once you have a partial order set, it's natural to take an inverse limit. This is a very general strategy still. Now here come the examples. So ergodic theory fits beautifully. I mean, this classical ergodic theory by Furstenberg. Of course, ergodic theory is something more general than this. This is just a small part of ergodic theory, of course, but this was the original. But this is just the zero step of ergodic theory. The work begins here, so this was nothing that I told you so far. Here is the second example. It's a nice, beautiful theory, although it's very new. but already many people are working on this. This is the Benjamin-Isham limit. First, let me explain an easy version of it. And in the easy version, you have the family of discrete objects is a graph. You fix a number d, a natural number d, and your objects are graphs with degree at most d. Okay? How do you sample? There are very natural sampling procedures. If you fix a number r, a natural number, then the corresponding sampling procedure is that you take a node, a vertex, uniformly at random from your graph, from your object here, and then you consider the neighborhood of wave with radius r in the graph. So what do I mean by a neighborhood? So if you have a graph with degree at most d, then there is it's a natural metric space with the distance. The distance of two points is the length of the shortest path connecting the two points. Okay? So, and this will be your sample. And of course, these sampling procedures are forming a partial ordered set, in a very trivial way. As you increase r, these are refinements of each other, these sampling procedures. So they get finer and finer. If you consider bigger and bigger neighborhood, if you consider a neighborhood of radius 10, then it contains all the information about the neighborhood distribution of radius 9, right? So these are finer and finer, and so you can do gluing. You can somehow glue these limiting procedures together to form one single probability distribution, probability Borel measure on the following space. So you take the space of rooted, but not necessarily finite graph, of degree at most d. And it's easy to make this space a topological space. Open subsets are those where you fix an R and you fix the neighborhood of radius R of the root. So if you fix this, then all these rooted graphs are forming an open neighborhood in this space. And okay, so it's easy to see that you can glue these limiting procedures together and you get a probability distribution basically on rooted infinite graphs or not necessarily finite graphs. So this is the limit object. Now, you can generalize this a little bit by replacing maximum degree by average degree. And still, everything goes true. So if you say that FD is the collection of graphs with average degree at most D, then you can still push everything through. You get a probability distribution on rooted infinite graphs. And so there are many interesting results about such objects. I just tell you two such results. So one is this is by Benjamin and Sham. Actually, this is the paper where the notion first appears. So this is where the limit notion is introduced, and they prove that if you take limit of planar graph, then this limiting distribution on rooted infinite graph is recurrent with probability 1. So that's the theorem. So once again, the limit object of planar graph is a probability distribution on rooted infinite graph, and this is recurrent with probability 1. Oh, that a random walk, if you do a random walk, then it goes back. And there is another by Omer Angel and Oded Schramm, They investigated random triangulations on the sphere. They proved many results about them. First of all, they proved that it exists, right? It's probability one if you take a limit of... So such a limit exists, and then you can prove many interesting results about this limit, which is a unique object. So this is... This was the third example, but it turns out that there is another very natural sampling procedure from graphs. So in the previous example, you just fix a random point, a random vertex, and then you take a neighborhood of radius r. But of course, there is another very natural sampling procedure, namely, if G is now the collection of all finite graphs, and the sampling is that you just simply pick k nodes uniformly at random, then you can take the span subgraph by this k nodes, and so a k sample is just a graph on these. So you label, this k random nodes by the first k natural number, and the span subgraph is just a graph on the first k natural number. So you get a, if you fix k, you get a distribution of graphs on this set. Okay, and again we take the closure of the graph with respect to the corresponding convergence notion, which is just that a graph sequence is convergent, so I could put it in another way, a graph sequence is called convergent if the frequency of any fixed subgraph in the sequence converges, like the edge density converges, the triangle density converges, and so on. This is the same. So if all these sampling procedures converge, then this is equivalent to saying that every subgraph density converges. So again, you get a gluing procedure, of these limiting procedures, which is a probability Borel measure on this compact topological space. So you take the two-element set and you raise it to this power. So what is this? N choose 2. So N is the set of natural numbers, and N choose 2 is the set of unordered pairs of natural numbers. So this is the space of those 0-1 sequences where the coordinates are indexed by unordered pairs of natural numbers. Okay? And there is a group action on this topological space, the finitely symmetric group that I denote by Sn is acting on this space. How? The group is actually, so this Sn is acting on the unordered pairs of integers, right? With the diagonal action. It is acting on the integers, it's acting on the unordered pairs, and then it's acting coordinate-wise on this topological space. And it turns out that you can glue these sampling procedures together, and then you get a probability probability Borel measure on this space, which is Sn invariant. So it's pretty much the same as the ergodic theory setting. So you have a some group action on some set omega. In this case, this set is n choose 2. You raise the two-element set to this power, and you let the group acting on this topological space, and you investigate invariant probability measures on this topological space. Now, there is an interesting fact here. So, you don't get, if you do this with graphs, you don't get every invariant probability measure as a limit object. In the ergodic theory setting, it was true that somehow all the Bernoulli shift invariant probability measures are limits of such subsets of cyclic groups. So there is a, so you get everything in that case. But in this case, you don't. You only get ergodic measures, exactly ergodic measures. That's a funny fact. So graph limits are, so the elements of the closure of graph are in a one-to-one correspondence with the ergodic measures on this space. So what is an ergodic measure? An ergodic measure is the same as usual. You don't have, you can't decompose the space into two subsets of positive measures, such that both subsets are invariant under this group action. Right? So this is a kind of an irreducibility criterion. And in other words, so another way of seeing it is that invariant probability measures on such a space are forming a convex set with the trivial convex combination. And the extremal points of this convex body are exactly the ergodic measures. So, and it turns out that graph limits are in a one-to-one correspondence with ergodic measures on this space. And Terry Tao also investigated this space, and he proved several ergodic type theorems for these weak limits. So he proved theorems that are analogous to classical theorems from ergodic theory in this new setting. Now, there is a structure theorem actually for this measure. By Laszlo Lovat and myself. So in this case, one can describe all such measures in a very natural way. So here is the structure theorem for graph limits. So if you have an element from the closure of the graph, then you can represent it by a two-variable measurable function on the unit interval. So you have a function from the unit square to the unit interval, which is symmetric in the two coordinates, such that this W encodes the limiting sampling procedures corresponding to this limit object in a natural way. So how do we describe sampling from a function? So that's what we have to describe now. So start with a function W and actually, it's a two-step randomization. So first, I describe for sampling from a W. So what is a random for sample? You pick four elements from the unit interval uniformly at random, okay? And you just look at this 4x4 submatrix that they define. You can see it as an infinite matrix, this function. So you get this 4x4 submatrix. So for example, this 0.3 here is just WX3X3, right? And so on. And then you do a second step randomization where you, first of all, you don't care about the diagonal, you just forget it, and second, you put an edge with these probabilities between two vertices. So you can, between two numbers with this probability. So you connect, for example, 3 and 1 with probability 0.5. So you flip a coin there, and so on. So this way, you get a random graph. So you start with a function, you fix the number 4, and you get a distribution of graphs on the first 4 natural numbers, right? So this is a very simple process. Actually, this is an interesting random graph model. So if you if you start with the constant p function, then you just get Erdős-Rényi. So this will be the graph model where you flip a coin independently for every edge of the graph. So this is a generalization of the Erdős-Rényi graph model.
What kind of function is W?
It's a measurable function. It has to be measurable. And you can express the corresponding subgraph densities with integral formulas like this. So, for example, the probability that a random tree sample is a triangle, if you start with a W, is exactly this integral. Because it's obvious. You pick x1, x2, x3 uniformly and random, and the probability that you get a triangle is exactly this, because you have to see an edge at between every two numbers, 1, 2, 3. And of course, the corresponding edge density is just the integral of the W, and then you can imagine how to calculate all the other subgraph densities. So it's pure analysis. So I just list some facts about graph limits, which are interesting. So first of all, as I mentioned, random graphs with edge probability p converge to the constant p function in this. So you can represent the limit object with the constant p function. Now, a second feature is that the previous theorem is closely related to Semeriad, this famous regularity lemma. Actually, it uses the proof of the of this structure theorem uses the regularity lemma. And it turns out that you can prove the regularity lemma from this structure theorem very easily. Third, so this language turns out to be useful in extremal combinatorics. Why? Because extremal problems have exact solutions in this closure. Like, for example, if you take, instead of the rational numbers, you take the real numbers and you want to minimize a polynomial, then it doesn't necessarily have a solution in the rational numbers. You can approximate it by rational numbers, but this extremal object exists in the realm of real numbers. So that's why it's useful, because you can formulate very easily extremal combinatorial problems for which the solution somehow doesn't exist as a graph, but it exists as a two-variable measurable function, which is an infinite analogy of a graph. Here is an interesting example. So assume that you want the edge density to be exactly 1/2, and you want the four-cycle density to be exactly 1 over 16. Then, so this is a result by Chang, Graham, Wilson. It's an old result, and it was formulated in a slightly different way back then. But anyhow, so you can approximate these values with an arbitrary precision by graphs. But it turns out that if you want to approximate them more and more, just these two densities, then the graph is more and more random looking. That's an amazing fact. So if you want to approximate these values, then you need a quasi-random graph. A quasi-random graph is a graph in which the density of every fixed graph is the same as it would be in the random graph, corresponding random graph, here with edge probability 1/2, okay? So there is no perfectly random graph among finite graphs. Because if you fix any finite graph and you want to sample two big subgraphs, then it won't look random, right? But there is a perfectly random object in this closure of graphs, namely the constant 1/2 function. So the theorem reformulated in this language, so this old theorem reformulated, states that if edge density is 1/2 and the four-cycle density is exactly 1/16, then the function is exactly the constant 1/2 function. So there is an exact solution to this extremal problem. But there are more complicated, so the language is useful in extremal combinatory, but also the methods are useful. So for example, Razborov recently using this language, and he actually further developed, so he's Sasha Razborov, he further developed it and he closed an old topic, which is the possible values of the triangle density if you determine the edge density. So the old question was, what can be the value of the triangle density if the edge density is, let's say, 7/11 or whatever. So he completely analyzed this question. It's a surprisingly hard question. So the next interesting feature is that actually, let me start with this. So limit objects are two variable measurable functions. So they are also integral kernels of operators. And there is a nice spectral theory for such integral kernels. So it means that the spectral theory of graphs generalizes to graph limits. And that was very useful in many applications. So there is a spectral theory for graph limits. Here's another interesting feature, that there is a dimension notion on graph limits. So this is again something which doesn't exist for finite graphs. All finite graphs are zero dimensional in some sense. So this is a notion which exists only if you consider this closure. But there is a dimension notion, and somehow this corresponds to the hardness of finding a Samaredi partition. So let me give you an example for this dimension notion. Assume that you start with a two-dimensional sphere. You pick points, many points, uniformly at random from this sphere, S2. And you connect two points with probability proportional to their distance. So you get a random graph model this way. Then you tend with the number of points to infinity, okay? So this sequence will converge with probability 1 to something, to a W, which is an interesting W. It's not a trivial W. It's not a constant function. And in this, according to this dimension notion, which is complicated, is defined as the Hausdorff dimension of some set, but according to this dimension notion, your limit object will have dimension 2. So somehow this dimension notion will remember the dimension of the sphere where you got the random graphs from, right? So you start with a two-dimensional object, the sphere, you generate random graphs, and somehow the limit object will remember the dimension of the sphere. So that's something interesting. So that allows you to do topology and stuff like that. So it also has a topological direction. But again, I don't have time to go into the details. I just want to outline many different directions that are in this topic.
Can you say the
Proportional to the, so let's say that the sphere is small, then it, you can say that it is exactly the distance.
So the further they are apart, the higher the probability of connection.
Yeah. Or this is a random graph model that you can define.
One is farther away, the more likely to be connected.
Yes. You can go exactly. So the thing is that if you take like 1 minus the distance, then again you get a two-dimensional object as the limit object. It doesn't matter. So according to this dimension notion, it doesn't matter. Okay, and recently Béla Bolobát, Jansson, and Riordan wrote a paper using these random graph models corresponding to W's. They investigate phase transitions and stuff like that. This is a extremely long paper. It's 135 pages long. It's a recent paper. So okay, so the next example is hypergraph. So although it might sound like just a boring generalization of the previous stuff, but it's not. It's probably the deepest case. Or you will see that it's interesting. So let's HD denote the set of D-uniform hypergraphs. D-uniform, what is a D-uniform hypergraph? So you have a set, and the D-uniform hypergraph is just a collection of D-element subsets of this set. So a graph, an ordinary graph, is just a collection of unordered pairs. So the sampling is again straightforward. If you want a K sample from such a D-uniform hypergraph, then you pick K nodes of the hypergraph and you look at the spanned subgraph, the spanned hypergraph by these random elements. So you have a sampling procedure. You can take the topological closure of this set. And again, you have also gluing. So what you have is, again, this ergodic situation. The limit object, what you can obtain by gluing, is a probability Borel measure on this space, where now, instead of n choose 2, you have n choose d here. So this is a compact topological space. And then a limit object in this sense, in a weak sense, is always always an Sn invariant probability measure on this space. And it again turns out, I proved that ergodic measures are in a one-to-one correspondence with the limit object. And again, in this paper by Terry Tao, he investigates other analogies of other ergodic theorems in this chapter. So the question is, this is a natural question, is there a similar structure theorem for such measures or for such hypergraph limits as in the graph case? Now, the bad news is that the most obvious choice, for example, if D is 3, then 3 variable functions are not enough. It's something surprising. So in the graph case, okay, you have 2 variable functions. It's pretty natural to represent a graph by a 2 variable function. It's somehow a continuous version of a graph. But here, something goes wrong. So there are certain hypergraphs. Let's just do 3 uniform. This is already complicated enough, so I don't want to do more. By the way, this part of the talk is a joint work with Gabor Elek. So there are sequences of 3 uniform hypergraphs whose limit can be represented by a 3 variable function in the previous way, as I described. You need a 6 variable function. So how does this look like? You have a six-variable function where the coordinates are indexed by 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 3, and 2, 3. So the second triple of coordinates have a different meaning as the first triple of coordinates. Okay? S3 is acting on these coordinates in the natural way. So we always assume that W is S3 symmetric in this sense. So it's symmetric with respect to this action on the coordinate. So what is, for example, a 4 sample from such a W? So a 4 sample is the following. We again have two-step randomization. The first step is that you pick 10 random elements from the unit interval, these elements. And then the second step randomization is that you, for example, so you will get a 3 uniform hypergraph on the first 4 natural numbers. You, for example, put a hyperedge on 1, 2, 4 with probability exactly W(x1, x2, x4, x1, 2, x1, 4, x2, 4. So in other words, okay, so what is going on here? You introduce random variables for the zero-dimensional object and for the one-dimensional object. And then you just if you want to compute the probability that you see a hyperedge on a certain subset, on a certain 3 subset of integers, then exactly you just have to substitute the corresponding variables into W and you get this probability. So that's the hypergraph model. And if you want to generalize it to K-uniform hypergraphs, you have to introduce variables for every subset, actually, of D, of the first D natural numbers. So here is the general statement. Limits of D uniform hypergraphs can be represented by 2 to the D minus 2 variable function. So here the variables correspond to non-trivial subsets of the first D natural numbers. So it's just a pure luck that 2 to the 2 minus 2 is 2. But 2 to the 3 minus 2 is not 3 anymore. So for this reason, graphs are special because they can be represented with a nice, in a nice visible way, which is very analogous to graphs. But here, with hypergraphs, the situation gets more complicated. And here is, again, I don't really have time to go into the details, but the method is interesting that we are using here. To simplify, so if you would want to prove it similarly as we did for graphs, you would need the so-called hypergraph regularity lemma. But this is an extremely complicated thing. It's very new, actually. It's by Rödl, Nagel, Skokand, Schacht. Then, independently, Gauer, Stau also came up with versions. It's a brand new and very complicated topic. And even if you want to use a hypergraph regularity lemma, which is like many pages to state, the proof of this would be extremely complicated. So this is how I first wanted to do. But then with Gabor Elek, we managed to find a shortcut using non-standard methods, ultralimits. So this is a part of logic, mathematical logic, and somehow things simplified miraculously. So it was actually too nice to be true, because not only that we didn't have to use summary, not only that we didn't have to use the regularity lemma for hypergraph, but we actually from this we got a very elegant version of it in a very simple way. So we managed to simplify the proof, but it was just a byproduct of our method. We also got a very short proof. Very short is like 10 and some pages for summary of the theorem on arithmetic progression in dense subset of the integers. So these are just byproducts, but we also managed to get that those measures can be represented by 2 to the d minus 2 variable function. So there is this ultra-limit method which seems to be quite powerful to handling limits of discrete structures somehow. But, of course, if you don't believe in the axiom of choice, then you are not allowed to use ultra-limits. So this requires the axiom of choice very heavily. Some more examples. Again, I don't really have time to go into the details, but I just have 2 minutes, so you can, instead of taking graphs, you can define the family of D-weighted graphs. So let's fix a real number, D, which is positive, and GD is the collection of graphs with edge weights from in this interval. So these are not that discrete anymore, but still discrete objects because they are graphs. And the K sample is just a weighted graph on the first K natural number, right? You fix K random points from such a graph, then what you see on this K point is a weighted graph. So you can also introduce the convergence notion, so, and it can be shown that the closure is a compact space. Again, there is gluing, and what you get is very similar to the previous situation. You have a probability distribution now on this compact space, so this minus dd interval is a compact space. You raise it to n choose 2 power, and you get an SN invariant probability measure, which is again ergodic. So, and there is, we have a structure theorem also. This is joint work with László Lovász. And the structure theorem is similar to the graph limit, but here instead of just two variable functions going to the unit interval, here you have something ugly. You have a two-variable function from the unit square going to probability distribution on this interval. So this is a probability distribution valued two-variable function. And you can define the notion of measurability for such things. I don't know. Don't explain it how. And of course, sampling from such objects is very straightforward. Again, a two-sampling is that you pick two random points, then you see a 4x4 matrix with probability distributions, and then you just pick a sample from these probability distributions, right? And then you get a weighted graph. And if you do this, for the first look, it looks like a pointless generalization, but it's not, because it's closely related, and to a topic in probability theory, which is called exchangeability of random variables. So if you do this, if you follow these lines, then you get structure theorems for exchangeable arrays of random variables. And I have 0 minutes. So I don't have time to explain this, but the setup is that you have a system of random variables, and there is some permutation group acting on this system of random variables, and you want to somehow characterize joint distributions that are invariant under these group action, and then the ancient example is the finity theorem, and there are generalizations, and you get even more generalized results from this setting, but I really don't have time to go into detail. So thank you very much.